AI affords extraordinary opportunities to make the digital experiences much, much better, much more customization, choice. I think it will revolutionize the way people interact with us digitally.
Welcome back to The Angle from T. Rowe Price, a podcast for curious investors. Just a reminder that outside of the U.S. and Australia, this podcast is for investment professionals only. For this episode of The Long View, I sat down with Chris Nassetta, President and CEO of Hilton. Chris has led Hilton for nearly two decades, navigating the global financial crisis, COVID, and the entrance of new competitors. We discussed his leadership journey, Hilton's evolution as a brand-led global business, the importance of culture, and how one of the world's most recognized travel brands continues to evolve.
So thanks for joining us on The Angle,
yeah,
Chris.
Happy really to do it, Eric. Thanks for having me.
So let's start kind of at the beginning. You grew up here in Northern Virginia, and one of the things that I've always
I grew up like nobody can see us, but 5 miles from where we're sitting is where I grew up, and I live about, believe it or not, I live about a mile from where I grew up.
So you haven't made it very far.
My mother's 93 years old, still lives in the house I grew up in, and yeah, so I did, you know, it's an interesting journey for me. I did live in Beverly Hills for a few years when I took this job almost 20 years ago. I had to move my family out there. And then, of course, we moved the business back. And in the hotel business, it's almost like a military life. Typically, you know, people move around the world. Like most of our senior people are moving all around the world, you know, every 2, 3, 4 years. My existence in the roles I've had is sort of the opposite. I have been, other than my time at Beverly Hills, I have been in and around DC as my home base, but I travel 80% of the time. So like a lot of my teams, they move every few years, but then they're relatively static where they are until they move again, where my life is like weekend warrior. You know, I'm home, you know, I try and make it home on a Friday night to Sunday morning. I'm off to China first thing Sunday, as an example, this coming Sunday. And so I'm gone, 75-80% of the time. But yes, this is my home base, born at Georgetown Hospital nearby.
Excellent. So one of the things that I love is that I think you were 16. You got your first job on Capitol Hill, but it wasn't like clerking for some powerful senator. You were in the engineering department. Proverbially the engineering department of a Holiday Inn. I think that means like plunging toilets and changing light bulbs.
And other things. It was 4th and C Street. And my parents were fabulous. My mom's still alive. My dad passed away. Fabulous parents. And like, if you wanted to have spending money and go to the movies and do all that kind of stuff, you had to have jobs. You had to make a living, so to speak, even as a kid. And so as a kid, I was super entrepreneurial, more than anybody wants to know. But I had a lot of different businesses, when I was upper single digits. And then into my early teen years of like lawn mowing business, paper route business, painting businesses, snow plowing. In part because I'm fairly entrepreneurial by nature, but in part out of necessity.
So when you graduated from UVA, you got into real estate development. So not directly into the hotel business, but into real estate development. What drew you to that business?
Well, it's interesting. I went to McIntyre School of Commerce at UVA, undergraduate business school, graduated a long time ago. And when I got out, like everybody, I was like trying to figure out what I wanted to do with my life. And at that time, what was most popular was like investment banking. That was like I don't know what the equivalent of like AI today, or, the internet, or, sharing economy, pick private equity. We go through these phases. Sometimes you have multiple industries that are sort of in favor. At that time, when I was coming out of business school, it was really investment banking and all the training programs. And I did all the interviewing for that. But my family, back to that, was in the real estate development business. And I didn't ever work there directly, but I worked with my father and uncle in other summers where I was like running numbers and doing things, back when we didn't have computers and literally like graph paper and a pencil and an eraser, And as I was interviewing for all the investment banking jobs and those, some of the great investment banks, I had some opportunities and great training programs. I realized I really, while I knew that would be good for me, that, I was more interested in being in and around real estate finance, and the like. And I wanted to like get to work. I mean, like, I'm a really sort of pragmatic, you know, hard work, and like, I want to go out and do stuff. So I started looking around and found an opportunity with Oliver Carr, which was the biggest regional developer, you know, Oliver Carr, who's still alive. By the way, I went last summer to his 100th birthday. An amazing person, built an amazing business. And I thought they were doing some really interesting things in terms of, he was very focused on city planning. He was very early in the days of the suburban expansion. And I just was swept away by all of that. And so, yeah, I got lucky, and I got, you know, I got offered an opportunity, you know, in those days. You know, I was, you know, fairly financially sophisticated, you know, enough so to be a financial analyst. Computers were just a new thing. Like, we were just, you know, people were starting to use computers. And the real estate development business, I would say, was not that financially sophisticated as it is today back then. So I found a really cool niche, and I realized that I had a unique skill set that didn't really exist at that time, but broadly, which was, you know, being a financial analyst and sort of, you know, and what I ended up doing is creating like a hub of people, and I recruited others. It wasn't a huge group, but a small group of others and a couple of others out of McIntyre. And so we became like, you know, we were the first ones that understood computers and like built the computer room. And like, we were like a hub of all financial analysis for a group of real estate development people whose background, who were incredibly talented, but whose background was much more construction management, architecture, engineering. And so it was sort of the merger of those skills, which are obviously very necessary and frankly critical to good real estate development, but then taking the financial analysis elements of it and connecting the dots. And so you think about like the early parts of your career, what is it really about? I tell my kids this, I tell our young people this. I mean, yeah, you got to make enough money to survive and pay rent and feed yourself, but it's really about learning.
So let's get to Hilton today. Hilton when you joined. So, you know, you come in, it's 2007. They've just done the biggest LBO at the time. We're right on the verge of the global financial crisis. We know
we didn't know that at the time.
We didn't know it.
We didn't know that. This is July 4th, 2007. So if you were to take yourself in a time capsule back, I think you would have, I mean, I think a lot of people, including me, thought, yeah, maybe we're getting long in the tooth on the business cycle. But nobody in July of 2007 thought the world was going to blow up the way it did. And I saw what was a really extraordinary opportunity. If you think about Hilton in that time, Hilton had just bought back Hilton International. They had fairly recently spun out the gaming business. They had bought Promise, that had a bunch of like Hampton Inn and Homewood and Embassy Suites and some of the limited service and other brands. But the big thing that was sort of missing, you know, for them was, you know, getting back the international business. So they did it. They bought HI Hilton International back, but it was within months that then they decided, you know, they were going to sell the business. But the company, I mean, Hilton's an amazing company. We invented the hotel business as you know it today. Okay. And I won't go through all the things we invented, but most of what is standard today, we invented. So it's an amazingly iconic company. But the reality is, because of, in part, the bifurcation of the business between U.S. and international and a lot of other things, we had really become, you know, I think, complacent and a laggard. So, you know, our culture, which had, you know, been extraordinary and led the industry, was sort of not what it needed to be. You know, if you looked at, you know, our brands were good, but we, you know, we had eight brands, and there were so many segments, you know, that we didn't cover. We had to expand our brand portfolio. Went from eight, we have 28 brands today, you know, and growing. We had to get Honors to really work. We just eclipsed 250 million members. We'll be 500 million members if all goes well in the next 5 years.
So let's level set on the business right now, because I think it's really interesting. It's truly an asset light business, right? You guys are running.
It wasn't always,
but you're
and
now.
That's a story we could do a whole podcast on of how we got from A to B.
So the way I think about it, and you tell me if this is wrong, but you really have two sets of customers, right? You have your, what I would say are your actual Hilton Honors members, your people who are coming into the hotels branded as Hilton and all the other 27 brands. And then you have the owners, the franchisees who are building, operating, day-to-day running these things. So how do you, first of all, explain the power of that flywheel that you have with those Hilton Honors members and the value that they bring. And then I want to get into how you serve two distinct sets of customers.
They are inexorably linked to one another. So the way the flywheel works is we develop great brands that really resonate with customers. We have a commercial platform, meaning sales, marketing, digital, all those things that really works well. And when they're building us more hotels, we're building the most important thing we have and that we continue to build, which is network effect. So the more that we can serve any customer for any need they have anywhere in the world they want to be with good products, good service, great technology and loyalty that ties it together and resonates with them, the higher share of wallet we get from every individual customer because we can. So, you know, like if you don't have all these dots on the map, in our case, almost 10,000 dots on the map in 146 countries, even if people like you and they say like, oh, I love him, you know, let's say, you know, I got a hotel in New York, but I'm going to, you know, a soccer tournament for my daughter in Reading, Pennsylvania. Well, if you only have really nice stuff in an urban market and you don't have the Hampton Inn or the Homewood or the Home 2 or the True in Reading, Pennsylvania, guess what? They're not staying with you. And so by definition, you're letting them out of the network. And so all of that flywheel is about continuing to strengthen the network effect and make it more and more powerful. But the way it coexists, and it coexists quite well, which is, we have to do with our ownership community, because remember, the majority of our system is franchise. So they're operating the majority of the system around the world. More here in the U.S. Is franchise, but it's growing everywhere in the world. They and we have to provide a great experience for the customer. And if we do that, we will drive higher rate occupancy, which allows you to drive greater profitability to the bottom line. The more profits they get at the bottom line, the more, you know, happy they are with how we're performing together and the more they want to reinvest in the business. So there are times in, you know, vis-a-vis the owners where like, you know, we have a very, you know, some owners have very long views. Some of them have intermediate, you know, everybody has different time horizons. As a consumer branded company, our time horizon, I mean, we have to mind all time horizons, like, because we got to deliver for owners. But our ultimate time horizon is forever. Like, you know, the Hampton brand or whatever, we're always thinking very long term on everybody's behalf, not just ours, but theirs. We have to protect the sanctity of these brands. And it stands to reason. If they're making more money, they're investing more and our flywheel flies faster.
So it's interesting. I think a couple of stats have really stood out to me. And correct me if I'm wrong on these, but I think I saw that 2 out of 3 people in a Hilton hotel at any point in time are Honors members.
Yes.
So like that loyalty is
yep. That's
very
about
powerful.
Right. A little bit higher than that, technically, but close. That's pretty close. And by the way, I think that's great. It leads the industry, but I think it'd be better. So like everything, I wake up every day. I can thank my 93-year-old mother who's wonderful for keeping me on task, thinking about, you know, not what we did yesterday and the success, and I'm proud of everything that we've done, but thinking about tomorrow. I mean, my kids, we were on vacation last week and they were kidding me about like, God, Dad, you're always just like tomorrow, the next thing. And I said, I can't help it. It's where I'm wired. So I'm thinking like with Honors being 67% to 70%, like what's the efficient frontier? And I think it's higher. I think it's, you know, I think it's closer to 75%. And so we have a plan and we're, you know, like, and when we get to that, I guess I'll have to figure out whether there's a new efficient frontier, but there are limits only in the sense of types of business that, you know, group business, types of business where it's not going to qualify.
The other thing I don't think people would fully appreciate is that, you know, your pipeline is large, 500,000 plus rooms.
540 that he's counting.
And, And I think that adds up to over $70 billion worth of investment, of which I think Hilton's on, you know, the record of saying something like, we'll do 575 or 580 million of that. The other 70 billion is going to come from—
Yeah, we spend a couple hundred million. We spend $150 to $200 million a year, something like that. So it's a, yeah, of that 70 billion, it's a teeny tiny percentage. And so listen, that is one of the really wonderful things about this model is it is capital light. And, you know, what we bought was a very different business. And in fact, what we went public with was a very different business where we owned a lot of real estate by number of assets, not a large percentage, but we owned some of the old big convention, you know, urban Hilton. So we owned a very large amount of real estate and we owned a very large timeshare business. And so, what we did, we went public in 13 and 16 against all odds. We were able to do a three-way split and convert the real estate company into a REIT, which was a miracle, by the way, because they changed the laws. You could never do it again. They changed the laws before we did it, but we got grandfathered in, which was a miracle. So as we sit here today, we're a consumer-branded business with these great brands. You know, we got to deliver for our owners, but we are very much a capital light business, and we have the ability to keep growing if we do our job, if we drive high premiums in terms of performance, which drives owners the flywheel to invest more. And obviously starting with customers liking everything we're doing, we can continue to grow without the use of much of any capital. Now, not everybody can do it, and in the sense that not all businesses are set up to be able to grow without the capital. At the moment we are, and if we do our job, it's sustainable, I think. And thus, I think we have a really good business model with quite a deep moat around it.
So I want to hit on two more topics here before we run out of time. And then we're
out of time already?
We're getting there.
I am loquacious.
You are loquacious, Chris.
As I have been accused.
We're going to end. We end all these sessions with a rapid fire. So I am going to hold you to that. All right.
You'd be surprised when.
I'm going to test you.
If you bet me like a buck, you know, I'm very competitive, then I'll be okay.
So I'm going to bet you a buck on two topics that we're going to try to do in 5 minutes, and then we're going to get to the perfect. It's down there. I love you. Still have cash. Then we're going to try to get to the rapid fire questions. But one is just the proliferation of brands in this business fascinates me, right? So you have 28 brands, as you mentioned, and I'm a Hilton Honors member, and I can't keep track of them all. Why do you need so many brands?
Well, the reality is, I'm not gonna accuse you of not being sophisticated, Eric, but the reality is by the way, we have fewer than our core competitors. Our core competitors have like 38, 42, 45. We have that many brands because our customers, I guess not you, but many of our other customers have told us that's what they want. So we do, listen, when I got here, we had eight. I said we have 28. All but two of those, and those were very recent, where we bought two brands, I mean, relatively small, because they were super unique opportunities. All the rest of them we did organically, and we did it the old-fashioned way, meaning it was driven, you know, sort of out of the earth by the needs and desires of our customers and our owners. And it's always that combination, as you pointed out. It's a symbiotic relationship. Like they're both equally important stakeholders. Our owners, many of them are operating these hotels. They're very close to the customers, what the customers' needs and, you know, wants are. And they were constantly doing research. I mean, I'm doing focus groups, Delore. I've got a bunch coming up in a few weeks. And listening to customers, our customers, other customer, you know, other brands' customers, at different segments, different age groups, everything under the sun. And all of these brands that we've developed have come out of those discussions. I know some people think like, oh my God, and you know, the hotel, they just keep putting it out there so they can like keep driving unit growth. Nothing's further from the truth. I mean, it does help unit growth, but you know, name a brand. We just the most recent launch is Undergraduate. I'll give you a good example. So you'd say like, oh my God, that's 28. Did you really need to do it, Chris? And I'd say, yeah, let me tell you why. I bought Undergraduate. It's one of the two we bought. Love the brand. By the way, my guess is anybody listening that stated it would say, love it. College towns, full service hotel, fabulous in big college towns. Okay, we have 36 or something. We probably have about, you know, that many more in a pipeline. You know, I think it could be two or three hundred hotels over a long period of time. Good growth. But what we found, like here's the example I gave. I had one daughter that went to Bucknell, right? It's in Lewisburg, Pennsylvania. Great little town. The biggest thing going on in Lewisburg besides Bucknell is the state penitentiary. You know, there are not a lot of hotels. There are no full service hotels. There's a Great Hampton I used to stay at and it's fabulous. The team there, if you're listening, you guys were great. But the reality, I realized like when we were doing graduate, why doesn't Lewisburg have one of these? And then you think, well, okay, there's a need for something a little bit more interesting in those towns. I think it would perform well. I think customers will want it. I mean, we did the work to make sure I was right. We didn't just like wing it. But the reality is if you took graduate to those towns, you would screw up that brand, meaning you would have to build a limited service hotel. So somebody would go to a graduate at Michigan and get this wow, or UVA, or, you know, Penn State. And then they'd go to Lewisburg and say like, what you like? So we created undergraduate because it needed to be in its own swim lane. Like, and when we went and did the research, and by the way, there's 500 or 700 of these little college towns, you know, scattered about the U.S. plus, you know, lots more overseas. And that meant that we could keep the integrity of the core graduate brand and do another brand that would be unique and different and serve a customer purpose and give our owners another opportunity to build something that we think would really perform well. So we then go do all the research and focus groups, you know, quantitative, qualitative data. I mean, we do all the work. And by the way, there are plenty of times where owners have come to me or I've had an idea or somebody on the team has had an idea and we do all the work and say, nah, reasonable to do the work, but it doesn't adapt. So there's a swim lane, the end point there. There is actually, I know it looks like 28 and how do you keep track? There is a swim lane and it isn't, you know, it's the ethos of the brand. It's the serving a stay occasion and or product type or and or price point. And so if you name a brand, I can, you know, we don't have to, it's like children, you know, I love them all. There's a reason for all of them. And here's the best testament I can give you to the fact that it works. Any of our brands and they're that are mature enough, meaning you've got, call it, 100 units or more is way outperforming the market, meaning, and they have not cannibalized their brethren.
Have you ever had to shut a brand down?
No, not yet. I hope to never get there, but that's a bad day, but no. So I think the truth is we do enough work where I don't think that'll ever happen.
All right. So last one before we jump into the rapid fire, the one way that AI is going to meaningfully change the business in 5 years?
Customer experience. Lots of other ways, customer experience. You think about the customer journey. It starts when you start thinking about taking a trip, either dreaming about a vacation and doing exploration, or you're getting out, you know, figuring out a business trip. It transitions to like planning it, booking it, pre-arrival. Then you're with us. I'll come back to that. And then when you're gone again, it's like post-stay feedback and like, what do we get right? What do we get wrong? So you think about that journey, the most important part of it is when people are with us, but there's a whole bunch of opportunities where people are engaging with us digitally when they're not with us. AI affords extraordinary opportunities to make the digital experiences much, much better. Much more customization, choice. We have so much information. We can serve you up micro servings, you know, based on everything we know about you, everything else you've done with us, everything else you've looked at and booked. So I think it already is, but early days, I think it will revolutionize the way people interact with us digitally. And then on stay, as well, because think about with the use of AI, with all the data that we have, and now the ability to actually use it in really productive ways, we can customize the experience ad infinite, I mean, in an unlimited way, because you're communicating with us. We're scraping social. In the moment, we can customize the offer or the experience in any way you want, fully integrated into our systems. And the last thing, because we could go on forever on AI, problem resolution. In the old days of problem resolution, it's like people will go down and scream, or they just wouldn't come back, or they'd go at the end of the stay and say it was terrible, and somebody'd say, I'll give you a bazillion honors points or whatever. Now we have the means through messaging, through scraping social, and fully integrated into our systems to deal with whatever your issues are in the moment while you're with us and fix it. And so I think the broader customer journey will be revolutionized.
All right, Chris, here comes the biggest challenge of your podcast interview session ever. Rapid fire, legitimately rapid fire. I'm going to give you a question and you have 1 to 10 words.
I'm going to do one word.
Okay, perfect. All right. Describe Hilton today.
Opportunity.
Best thing about being the CEO of Hilton?
Our people.
What's one thing you always notice when you walk into a hotel?
The smiles on people's faces.
What's your most used travel hack?
My charger, a very special charger.
I want to find out about that later. Okay. What's a city you visited many times but never get tired of?
Oh my, every city I get. I love the world everywhere I go.
Oh, then this is how you're going to answer this one too. What's the most memorable hotel you've ever stayed in?
I don't have a favorite hotel. I love all my children. The last one I was in, what was the last hotel I was in? Resorts World, Las Vegas was the last. But I find something to love in every hotel we have, mostly related to the people.
If you weren't in hospitality, what career would you have pursued?
Oh, probably the one I was pursuing, real estate and finance.
What's the most underrated trait of a great leader?
Humility.
One word to describe the environment you're operating in right now.
Dynamic.
Excellent. You did it. I owe you a buck. Thank you so much. I want to see your charger.
Again, I'm Eric Vile. Thank you for listening to The Angle. We look forward to your company on future episodes. You can find more information about this and other topics on our website. Please rate and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. The Angle. Better questions, better insights, only from T. Rowe Price.
This podcast episode was recorded in July of 2026 and is for general information and educational purposes only. Outside of the United States and Australia, it is for investment professional use only. It is not intended to be used by persons in jurisdictions which prohibit or restrict distribution of the material herein. This podcast episode does not give advice or recommendations of any nature or constitute an offer or solicitation to buy or sell any security in any jurisdiction. Prospective investors should seek independent legal, financial, and tax advice before making any investment decision. Past performance is not a guarantee or a reliable indicator of future results. All investments are subject to risk, including the possible loss of principal. Discussions relating to specific securities are informational only and are not recommendations, and may or may not have been held in any T. Rowe Price portfolio. Any forward-looking statements are for discussion purposes only and are never guaranteed. There should be no assumption that the securities were or will be profitable. T. Rowe Price is not affiliated with or a subsidiary of any company discussed. The views contained herein are those of the speakers as of the date of the recording and are subject to change without notice. These views may differ from those of other T. Rowe Price associates and or affiliates. Information is from sources deemed reliable but not guaranteed. Please visit https://www.troweprice.com/en/uk/insights/the-long-view-Hilton for full global issuer disclosures. This podcast is copyright by T. Rowe Price, 2026.